God created Arrakis to train the faithful. From the Wisdom of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan. In the stillness of the cavern, Jessica heard the scrape of sand on rock as people moved, the distant bird calls that Stilgar had said were the signals of his watchmen. The great plastic hood seals had been removed from the cave's opening. She could see the march of evening shadows across the lip of rock in front of her and the open basin beyond. She sensed the daylight leaving them, sensed it in the dry heat as well as the shadows. She knew her trained awareness soon would give her what these Fremen obviously had, the ability to sense even the slightest change in the air's moisture. How they had scurried to tighten their stillsuits when the cave was opened. Deep within the cave, someone began chanting, "Ima Trava Okolo, Ikorenja Okolo." Jessica translated silently, "These are ashes, and these are roots." The funeral ceremony for Jameis was beginning. She looked out at the Arrakeen sunset, at the banked decks of color in the sky. Night was beginning to utter its shadows along the distant rocks and the dunes. Yet the heat persisted. Heat forced her thoughts onto water and the observed fact that this whole people could be trained to be thirsty only at given times. Thirst. She could remember moonlit waves on Caladan throwing white robes over rocks, and the wind heavy with dampness. Now the breeze that fingered her robes seared the patches of exposed skin at cheeks and forehead. The new nose plugs irritated her, and she found herself overly conscious of the tube that trailed down across her face into the suit, recovering her breath's moisture. The suit itself was a sweatbox. "Your suit will be more comfortable when you've adjusted to a lower water content in your body," Stilgar had said. She knew he was right, but the knowledge made this moment no more comfortable. The unconscious preoccupation with water here weighed on her mind. No, she corrected herself. It was preoccupation with moisture. And that was a more subtle and profound matter. She heard approaching footsteps, turned to see Paul come out of the cave's depths, trailed by the elfin-faced Chaney. There's another thing, Jessica thought. Paul must be cautioned about their women. One of these desert women would not do as wife to a duke. As concubine, yes, but not as wife. Then she wondered at herself, thinking, have I been infected with his schemes? And she saw how well she had been conditioned. I can think of the marital needs of royalty without once weighing my own concubinage. Yet, I was more than concubine. Mother. Paul stopped in front of her. Chaney stood at his elbow. Mother, do you know what they're doing back there? Jessica looked at the dark patch of his eyes, staring out from the hood. I think so. Chaney showed me. Because I'm supposed to see it and give my permission for the weighing of the water. Jessica looked at Chaney. They're recovering Jameis's water, Chaney said, and her thin voice came out nasal past the nose plugs. It's the rule. The flesh belongs to the person, but his water belongs to the tribe. Except in the combat. They say the water's mine, Paul said. Jessica wondered why this should make her suddenly alert and cautious. Combat water belongs to the winner, Chaney said. It's because you have to fight in the open without stillsuits. The winner has to get his water back that he loses while fighting. I don't want his water, Paul muttered. He felt that he was a part of many images moving simultaneously in a fragmenting way that was disconcerting to the inner eye. He could not be certain what he would do, but of one thing he was positive. He did not want the water distilled out of Jameis's flesh. "It's water," Chaney said. Jessica marveled at the way she said it. Water. So much meaning in a simple sound. A Bene Gesserit axiom came to Jessica's mind. Survival is the ability to swim in strange water. And Jessica thought, Paul and I, we must find the currents and patterns in these strange waters if we are to survive. You will accept the water, Jessica said. She recognized the tone in her voice. She had used that same tone once with Leto, telling her lost Duke that he would accept a large sum offered for his support in a questionable venture, because money maintained power for the Atreides. On Arrakis, water was money. She saw that clearly. Paul remained silent, knowing then that he would do as she ordered, not because she ordered it, but because her tone of voice had forced him to reevaluate. To refuse the water would be to break with accepted Fremen practice. Presently, Paul recalled the words of 467 Kalima in Yui's OC Bible. He said, "From water does all life begin." Jessica stared at him. Where did he learn that quotation? She asked herself. He hasn't studied the mysteries. Thus it is spoken, Chaney said. Judishar Mantine. It is written in the Shahnameh that water was the first of all things created. For no reason she could explain, and this bothered her more than the sensation, Jessica suddenly shuddered. She turned away to hide her confusion and was just in time to see the sunset. A violent calamity of color spilled over the sky as the sun dipped beneath the horizon. It is time. The voice was Stilgar's ringing in the cavern. Jameis's weapon has been killed. Jameis has been called by him, by Shai Hulud, who has ordained the phases for the moons that daily wane and, in the end, appear as bent and withered twigs. Stilgar's voice lowered. Thus it is with Jameis. Silence fell like a blanket on the cavern. Jessica saw the gray shadow movement of Stilgar like a ghost figure within the dark inner reaches. She glanced back at the basin, sensing the coolness. The friends of Jameis will approach, Stilgar said. Men moved behind Jessica, dropping a curtain across the opening. A single glow globe was lighted overhead far back in the cave. Its yellow glow picked out an inflowing of human figures. Jessica heard the rustling of the robes. Chaney took a step away, as though pulled by the light. Jessica bent close to Paul's ear, speaking in the family code. Follow their lead. Do as they do. It will be a simple ceremony to placate the shade of Jameis. It will be more than that, Paul thought. And he felt a wrenching sensation within his awareness as though he were trying to grasp something in motion and render it motionless. Chaney glided back to Jessica's side, took her hand. Come, Sayedina. We must sit apart. Paul watched them move off into the shadows, leaving him alone. He felt abandoned. The men who had fixed the curtain came up beside him. Come, Usul. He allowed himself to be guided forward, to be pushed into a circle of people being formed around Stilgar, who stood beneath the glow globe and beside a bundled, curving, and angular shape gathered beneath a robe on the rock floor. The troop crouched down at a gesture from Stilgar, their robes hissing with the movement. Paul settled with them, watching Stilgar, noting the way the overhead globe made pits of his eyes and brightened the touch of green fabric at his neck. Paul shifted his attention to the robe-covered mound at Stilgar's feet, recognized the handle of a balisset protruding from the fabric. "The spirit leaves the body's water when the first moon rises," Stilgar intoned. "Thus it is spoken. When we see the first moon rise this night, whom will it summon?" "Jamis," the troop responded. Stilgar turned full circle on one heel, passing his gaze across the ring of faces. "I was a friend of Jamis," he said. "When the hawk plane stooped upon us at Hole in the Rock, it was Jamis pulled me to safety." He bent over the pile beside him, lifted away the robe. "I take this robe as a friend of Jamis. Leader's right." He draped the robe over a shoulder, straightening. Now, Paul saw the contents of the mound exposed. The pale, glistening gray of a stillsuit, a battered leaderjohn, a kerchief with a small book in its center, the bladeless handle of a kris knife, an empty sheath, a folded pack, a paracompass, a distrans, a thumper, a pile of fist-sized metallic hooks, an assortment of what looked like small rocks within a fold of cloth, a clump of bundled feathers, and the balisset exposed beside the folded pack. So Jamis played the balisset, Paul thought. The instrument reminded him of Gurney Halleck and all that was lost. Paul knew, with his memory of the future in the past, that some chance lines could produce a meeting with Halleck, but the reunions were few and shadowed. They puzzled him. The uncertainty factor touched him with wonder. "Does it mean that something I will do, that I may do, could destroy Gurney? Or bring him back to life? Or..." Paul swallowed, shook his head. Again, Stilgar bent over the mound. "For Jamis's woman and for the guards," he said. The small rocks and the book were taken into the folds of his robe. "Leader's right," the troop intoned. "The marker for Jamis's coffee service," Stilgar said, and he lifted a flat disc of green metal. "That it shall be given to Usul in suitable ceremony when we return to the Siege." "Leader's right," the troop intoned. Lastly, he took the kris knife handle and stood with it. "For the funeral plane," he said. "For the funeral plane," the troop responded. At her place in the circle across from Paul, Jessica nodded, recognizing the ancient source of the rite, and she thought, the meeting between ignorance and knowledge, between brutality and culture. It begins in the dignity with which we treat our dead. She looked across at Paul, wondering, will he see it? Will he know what to do? "We are friends of Jamis," Stilgar said. "We are not wailing for our dead like a pack of Garvark." A gray-bearded man to Paul's left stood up. "I was a friend of Jamis," he said. He crossed to the mound, lifted the distrans. "When our water went below Minim at the siege of Two Birds, Jamis shared." The man returned to his place in the circle. "Am I supposed to say I was a friend of Jamis?" Paul wondered. "Do they expect me to take something from that pile?" He saw faces turn toward him, turn away. "They do expect it." Another man across from Paul arose, went to the pack and removed the paracompass. "I was a friend of Jamis," he said. "When the patrol caught us at Bight of the Cliff and I was wounded, Jamis drew them off so the wounded could be saved." He returned to his place in the circle. Again the faces turned toward Paul, and he saw the expectancy in them. lowered his eyes. An elbow nudged him, and a voice hissed, "Would you bring the destruction on us?" "How can I say I was his friend?" Paul wondered. Another figure arose from the circle opposite Paul, and as the hooded face came into the light, he recognized his mother. She removed a kerchief from the mount. "I was a friend of Jameis," she said. "When the spirit of spirits within him saw the needs of truth, that spirit withdrew and spared my son." She returned to her place. And Paul recalled the scorn in his mother's voice as she had confronted him after the fight. "How does it feel to be a killer?" Again, he saw the faces turned toward him, felt the anger and fear in the troop. A passage his mother had once film-booked for him on the cult of the dead flickered through Paul's mind. He knew what he had to do. Slowly, Paul got to his feet. A sigh passed around the circle. Paul felt the diminishment of his self as he advanced into the center of the circle. It was as though he lost a fragment of himself and sought it here. He bent over the mound of belongings, lifted out the baliset. A string twanged softly as it struck against something in the pile. "I was a friend of Jameis," Paul whispered. He felt tears burning his eyes, forced more volume into his voice. "Jameis taught me that when you kill, you pay for it. I wish I'd known Jameis better." Blindly, he groped his way back to his place in the circle, sank to the rock floor. A voice hissed, "He sheds tears." It was taken up around the ring. "Usul gives moisture to the dead." He felt fingers touch his damp cheek, heard the awed whispers. Jessica, hearing the voices, felt the depth of the experience, realized what terrible inhibitions there must be against shedding tears. She focused on the words, "He gives moisture to the dead." It was a gift to the shadow world. Tears. They would be sacred beyond a doubt. Nothing on this planet had so forcefully hammered into her the ultimate value of water. Not the water sellers, not the dried skins of the natives, not still suits or the rules of water discipline. Here there was a substance more precious than all others. It was life itself, and entwined all around with symbolism and ritual. Water. "I touched his cheek," someone whispered. "I felt the gift." At first, the fingers touching his face frightened Paul. He clutched the cold handle of the baliset, feeling the strings bite his palm. Then he saw the faces beyond the groping hands, the eyes wide and wondering. Presently, the hands withdrew. The funeral ceremony resumed. But now, there was a subtle space around Paul, a drawing back as the troop honored him by a respectful isolation. The ceremony ended with a low chant. "Full moon calls thee, Shai-Hulud shalt thou see, red the night, dusky sky, bloody death didst thou die. We pray to a moon, she is round. Luck with us will then abound. What we seek for shall be found in the land of solid ground." A bulging sack remained at Stilgar's feet. He crouched, placed his palms against it. Someone came up beside him, crouched at his elbow, and Paul recognized Chaney's face in the hood shadow. "Jameis carried 33 liters and 7 3/32 drachms of the tribe's water," Chaney said. "I bless it now in the presence of a Sayyidina," Ekeri Akairi, this is the water, Filisin Falasi of Paul Moadib. Kivi Akavi, never the more, Nakalas, Nakalas, to be measured and counted. Ukair An, by the heartbeats, Jean, of our friend, Jameis. In an abrupt and profound silence, Chaney turned, stared at Paul. Presently she said, "Where I am flame, be thou the coals. Where I am dew, be thou the water." Bilal Kaifa intoned the troop. "To Paul Muad'Dib goes this portion," Chaney said. "May he guard it for the tribe, preserving it against careless loss. May he be generous with it in time of need. May he pass it on in his time for the good of the tribe." Bilal Kaifa intoned the group. "I must accept that water," Paul thought. Slowly he arose, made his way to Chaney's side. Stilgar stepped back to make room for him, took the balisette gently from his hand. "Kneel," Chaney said. Paul knelt. She guided his hands to the water bag, held them against the resilient surface. "With this water the tribe entrusts thee," she said. "Jameis is gone from it. Take it in peace." She stood, pulling Paul up with her. Stilgar returned the balisette, extended a small pile of metal rings in one palm. Paul looked at them, seeing the different sizes, the way the light of the glow globe reflected off them. Chaney took the largest ring, held it on a finger. 30 liters, she said. One by one, she took the others, showing each to Paul, counting them. 2 liters. 1 liter. 7 water counters of 1 drachm each. 1 water counter of 3 32nd drachms. In all, 33 liters and 7 3/32nd drachms. She held them up on her finger for Paul to see. "Do you accept them?" Stilgar asked. Paul swallowed, nodded. "Yes." "Later," Chaney said, "I will show you how to tie them in a kerchief so they won't rattle and give you away when you need silence." She extended her hand. "Will you hold them for me?" Paul asked. Chaney turned a startled glance on Stilgar. He smiled, said, "Paul Muad'Dib, who is Usul, does not yet know our ways, Chaney. Hold his water counters without commitment until it's time to show him the manner of carrying them." She nodded, whipped a ribbon of cloth from beneath her robe, linked the rings onto it with an intricate over and under weaving, hesitated, then stuffed them into the sash beneath her robe. "I missed something there," Paul thought. He sensed the feeling of humor around him, something bantering in it, and his mind linked up a prescient memory. Water counters offered to a woman. Courtship ritual. "Water masters," Stilgar said. The troop arose in a hissing of robes. 2 men stepped out, lifted the water bag. Stilgar took down the glow globe, led the way with it into the depths of the cave. Paul was pressed in behind Chaney, noted the buttery glow of light over rock walls, the way the shadows danced, and he felt the troop's lift of spirits contained in a hushed air of expectancy. Jessica, pulled into the end of the troop by eager hands, hemmed around by jostling bodies, suppressed a moment of panic. She had recognized fragments of the ritual, identified the shards of Chakobsa and Botani Jib in the words, and she knew the wild violence that could explode out of these seemingly simple moments. Jean, she thought. Go, go, go. It was like a child's game, that had lost all inhibition in adult hands. Stilgar stopped at a yellow rock wall. He pressed an outcropping and the wall swung silently away from him, opening along an irregular crack. He led the way through, past a dark honeycomb lattice that directed a cool wash of air across Paul when he passed it. Paul turned a questioning stare on Chaney, tugged her arm. "That air felt damp," he said. "Shh," she whispered. But a man behind them said, "Plenty of moisture in the trap tonight. Jameis's way of telling us. He's satisfied." Jessica passed through the secret door, heard it close behind. This book is continued on disc 14. Jessica passed through the secret door, heard it close behind. She saw how the Fremen slowed while passing the honeycomb lattice, felt the dampness of the air as she came opposite it. Wind trap, she thought. They have a concealed wind trap somewhere on the surface to funnel air down here into cooler regions and precipitate the moisture from it. They passed through another rock door with latticework above it, and the door closed behind them. The draft of air at their backs carried a sensation of moisture clearly perceptible to both Jessica and Paul. At the head of the troop, the glow globe in Stilgar's hands dropped below the level of the heads in front of Paul. Presently he felt steps beneath his feet, curving down to the left. Light reflected back up across hooded heads and a winding movement of people spiraling down the steps. Jessica sensed mounting tension in the people around her, a pressure of silence that rasped her nerves with its urgency. The steps ended and the troop passed through another low door. The light of the glow globe was swallowed in a great open space with a high curved ceiling. Paul felt Chaney's hand on his arm, heard a faint dripping sound in the chill air, felt an utter stillness come over the Fremen in the cathedral presence of water. "I have seen this place in a dream," he thought. The thought was both reassuring and frustrating. Somewhere ahead of him on this path, the fanatic hordes cut their gory path across the universe in his name. The green and black Atreides banner would become a symbol of terror. Wild legions would charge into battle, screaming their war cry, "Muad'Dib!" "It must not be," he thought. "I cannot let it happen." But he could feel the demanding race consciousness within him, his own terrible purpose, and he knew that no small thing could deflect the juggernaut. It was gathering weight and momentum. If he died this instant, the thing would go on through his mother and his unborn sister. Nothing less than the deaths of all the troop gathered here and now, himself and his mother included, could stop the thing. Paul stared around him, saw the troop spread out in a line. They pressed him forward against a low barrier carved from native rock. Beyond the barrier in the glow of Stilgar's globe, Paul saw an unruffled dark surface of water. It stretched away into shadows, deep and black, the far wall only faintly visible, perhaps 100 meters away. Jessica felt the dry pulling of skin on her cheeks and forehead relaxing in the presence of moisture. The water pool was deep. She could sense its deepness and resisted a desire to dip her hands into it. A splashing sounded on her left. She looked down the shadowy line of Fremen, saw Stilgar with Paul standing beside him, and the watermasters emptying their load into the pool through a flow meter. The meter was a round gray eye above the pool's rim. She saw its glowing pointer move as the water flowed through it, saw the pointer stop at 33 liters, 7 3/32 drachms. Superb accuracy in water measurement, Jessica thought. and she noted that the walls of the meter trough held no trace of moisture after the water's passage. The water flowed off those walls without binding tension. She saw a profound clue to Fremen technology in the simple fact. They were perfectionists. Jessica worked her way down the barrier to Stilgar's side. Way was made for her with casual courtesy. She noted the withdrawn look in Paul's eyes, but the mystery of this great pool of water dominated her thoughts. Stilgar looked at her. "There were those among us in need of water," he said. "Yet they would come here and not touch this water. Do you know that?"
"I believe it," she said.
He looked at the pool. "We have more than 38 million decaliters here," he said, "walled off from the little makers, hidden and preserved."
"A treasure trove," she said.
Stilgar lifted the globe to look into her eyes. "It is greater than treasure. We have thousands of such caches. Only a few of us know them all." He cocked his head to one side. The globe cast a yellow-shadowed glow across face and beard. "Hear that?" They listened. The dripping of water precipitated from the wind trap filled the room with its presence. Jessica saw that the entire troop was caught up in a rapture of listening. Only Paul seemed to stand remote from it. To Paul, the sound was like moments ticking away. He could feel time flowing through him, the instants never to be recaptured. He sensed a need for decision, but felt powerless to move. "It has been calculated with precision," Stilgar whispered. "We know to within a million decaliters how much we need. When we have it, we shall change the face of Arrakis." A hushed whisper of response lifted from the troop. "Bilal Khalifa. We will trap the dunes beneath grass plantings," Stilgar said, his voice growing stronger. "We will tie the water into the soil with trees and undergrowth." "Bilal Khalifa," intoned the troop. "Each year, the polar ice retreats," Stilgar said. "Bilal Khalifa," they chanted. "We shall make a homeworld of Arrakis, with melting lenses at the poles, with lakes in the temperate zones, and only the deep desert for the maker and his spice. Bilal Khalifa. And no man ever again shall want for water. It shall be his for dipping from well or pond or lake or canal. It shall run down through the canuts to feed our plants. It shall be there for any man to take. It shall be his for holding out his hand. Bilal Khalifa." Jessica felt the religious ritual in the words, noted her own instinctively awed response. "They're in league with the future," she thought. "They have their mountain to climb. This is the scientist's dream. And these simple people, these peasants, are filled with it." Her thoughts turned to Liet Kynes, the Emperor's planetary ecologist, the man who had gone native, and she wondered at him. This was a dream to capture men's souls, and she could sense the hand of the ecologist in it. This was a dream for which men would die willingly. It was another of the essential ingredients that she felt her son needed. People with a goal. Such people would be easy to imbue with fervor and fanaticism. They could be wielded like a sword to win back Paul's place for him. "We leave now," Stilgar said, "and wait for the first moon's rising. When Jamis is safely on his way, We will go home.
Whispering their reluctance, the troop fell in behind him, turned back along the water barrier and up the stairs. And Paul, walking behind Cheney, felt that a vital moment had passed him, that he had missed an essential decision and was now caught up in his own myth. He knew he had seen this place before, experienced it in a fragment of prescient dream on faraway Caladan, but details of the place were being filled in now that he had not seen. He felt a new sense of wonder at the limits of his gift. It was as though he rode within the wave of time, sometimes in its trough, sometimes on a crest, and all around him the other waves lifted and fell, revealing and then hiding what they bore on their surface. Through it all, the wild jihad still loomed ahead of him, the violence and the slaughter. It was like a promontory above the surf. The troop filed through the last door into the main cavern. The door was sealed. Lights were extinguished, hoods removed from the cavern openings, revealing the night and the stars that had come over the desert. Jessica moved to the dry lip of the cavern's edge, looked up at the stars. They were sharp and near. She felt the stirring of the troop around her, heard the sound of a balisette being tuned somewhere behind her, and Paul's voice humming the pitch. There was a melancholy in his tone that she did not like. Cheney's voice intruded from the deep cave darkness. "Tell me about the waters of your birth world, Paul Muad'Dib." "And Paul?" "Another time, Cheney. I promise." "Such sadness." "It's a good balisette," Cheney said. "Very good," Paul said. "Do you think Jameis will mind my using it?" "He speaks of the dead in the present tense," Jessica thought. The implications disturbed her. A man's voice intruded. "He liked music betimes, Jameis did." "Then sing me one of your songs," Cheney pleaded. Such feminine allure in that girl child's voice, Jessica thought. "I must caution Paul about their women. And soon." "This was a song of a friend of mine," Paul said. "I expect he's dead now, Gurney is." "He called it his evensong." The troop grew still, listening as Paul's voice lifted in a sweet boy tenor with the balisette tinkling and strumming beneath it. "This clear time of seeing embers, a gold-bright sun's lost in first dusk, what frenzied senses, desperate musk, our consort of remembering." Jessica felt the verbal music in her breast, pagan and charged with sounds that made her suddenly and intensely aware of herself, feeling her own body and its needs. She listened with a tense stillness. "Night's pearl-censored requiem, 'tis for us. What joys run, then, bright in your eyes? What flower-spangled amores pull at our hearts? What flower-spangled amores fill our desires?" And Jessica heard the after stillness that hummed in the air with the last note. "Why does my son sing a love song to that girl child?" she asked herself. She felt an abrupt fear. She could sense life flowing around her, and she had no grasp on its reins. Why did he choose that song? She wondered. The instincts are true sometimes. Why did he do this? Paul sat silently in the darkness, a single stark thought dominating his awareness. "My mother is my enemy. She does not know it, but she is. She is bringing the jihad. She bore me. She trained me. She is my enemy.